The views expressed on the following broadcasts do not necessarily reflect those of KHLT, Take 12 Radio, or our affiliates. The opinions on this show should not be considered as medical, psychological, or professional advice and are those of the host, co-host, and guest. Take 12 Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting are not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship.
One day at a time with its failures and fears. Portion of pain and burden of care, we must meet.
Welcome to Walking Through the Language of the Heart, a journey into the grapevine writings of Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill W. And now, here are your co-hosts, Chris S. and the Monty Man.
Well, here we are, my friends, back at you. The dynamic duo, the two guys, I think we said in the Walking Through the Big Book something like the two guys that investigate prior to contempt or something like that.
Yeah, I remember that.
But here we are, folks, with yet another episode. I think this is episode 66.
Wow.
I just had a squeak in my voice.
And Monty, we are raring to go.
We are.
I hope you had a good week.
I did have an excellent week. So launch us forth here, my brother.
All right. We are in part three, which is 58 to 70. It's the last part of Language of the Heart. Mm-hmm. We're on page 242. And the title of the essay that we're gonna go over this week and next, because it's pretty long,
yes,
is called The Language of the Heart.
Nope.
Which is the name of the book. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So let's see. What I know about Bill is he thought that sometimes when we were communicating a certain way, it was really coming from our heart. And I'm not sure exactly what he's going to say in this essay. I certainly don't remember reading it 30 years ago or whenever I did. So I'm interested to hear his perspective on this. And this was written in July 1960, The Language of the Heart. My workshop stands on a hill back of our home. That's Wits End, and I've actually been in there. It's very cool, Monty. It's smaller than a one-car garage, and it's like a little studio, you know, with a desk and his ashtrays, you know, a little
yeah.
fireplace. And he would escape up there. It was his man cave is really what it was.
Right. Wow.
And it says, looking over the valley, I see the village community house where our local group meets. Beyond the circle of my horizon lies the one world of AA. 8,000 groups, a quarter of a million of us. How in 25 years did AA get the way it is, and where we are going from here? So how about that?
Wow.
A quarter of a million people by 1960 are in AA. And what did he say? 6,000 groups?
Gee whiz! I mean, that's a lot now.
Yeah, that certainly is. Often I sense the deep meaning of the phenomenon of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I cannot begin to fathom it. Why, for instance, at this particular point in history has God chosen to communicate his healing grace to so many of us? Who can say what this communication actually is, so mysterious and yet so practical? We can only partly realize what we have received and what it has meant to each of us. Hmm. You know, the steps are something that you can only really understand from experience.
Yeah.
You know, I know so many people look at the steps and intellectualize the steps,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't give you 5% of what the steps mean when they're actually taken.
Yeah.
And so he's talking about, you know, how do we fathom it? You know, and God chose to communicate it. He believes that the guidance of God was operable in his life when he was putting these 12 steps down on paper. So that's interesting. It occurs to me that every aspect of this global unfoldment can be related to a single crucial word. The word is communication. There has been a life-saving communication among ourselves, with the world around us, and with God. From the beginning, communication in AA has been no ordinary transmission of helpful ideas and attitudes. It has been unusual and sometimes unique. Because of our kinship and suffering, and because of our common means of deliverance are effective for ourselves only when constantly carried to others, our channels of contrast have always been charged with the language of the heart. And what is that? Let's see if I can communicate to you something of what it means to me. So that's interesting, but I want to read this again. Because our kinship and suffering, and because of our common means of deliverance are effective for ourselves only when constantly carried to others. So every once in a while, you know, somebody will show up in the group and they'll raise their hand, and they've been in AA a while, right? You know, they might have even done some steps. They've been to treatment. They've been treated. And they'll relapse, and they'll come back in astounded. You know, why did I relapse? Why did I relapse? And a lot of times I'll ask them some questions like, you know, well, did you complete your amends? Did you make direct amends to the people and institutions you formed? Mm-hmm. Well, no. Were you actively, passionately working with other people? Were you sponsoring and taking other people through the steps? And they'll say, no. And then I'll say something that no one else tells them. I'll say, then you were supposed to drink.
Yeah.
According to our literature.
Yeah.
Right. According to our, I'm basing it on literature. It's not my opinion.
You know,
you know,
and then one of the platitudes that we hear all the time, you can't keep it unless you give it away. You can't keep it unless you give it away. We hear it over and over. We preach it from the mountaintops. It's a spiritual concept, you know, with all major forms of faith. I mean, you just, if you want to hold on to something precious, you have to be willing to give it away. And we say that, and yet we're confused. If we relapse, it's like we don't have a clue. So what if we, so if I'm sober for 28 years and I relapse, why is it that I don't have a clue? You would think, and I've been going to meetings. I've been pouring a coffee and unlocking the door. And to me, that is a form of service work in early on. But after years and years, it just doesn't suffice, in my opinion. Just my opinion.
Right.
But why is it, Chris, that after preaching this stuff, we don't have a clue when it hits us between the eyes?
Because I think an aspect of alcoholism is an inability to accurately assess our own spiritual life. You know, like that, and that's why we have sponsors. It's their job to assess our spiritual fortitude and pay attention to whether we're meeting step service and sponsoring. You know, it's kind of their job, because we can get lost in the weeds.
Yeah.
And it can happen to anybody. We can rest on our laurels and trouble will soon follow. And we're not really aware of or mindful of the fact that we've been resting on our laurels, because it happens in such a slow, you know, slow way. You know, we inch away from the things that are keeping us sober. We don't jump away from them. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the way I see it, you know, and again, I certainly could be wrong. Each case has its own unique dynamics, I know, but the one thing I'm sure of is the people that are consistent with meeting step service and sponsorship, consistent, are usually the ones that are in really good shape. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, you bet. And you don't hear, I don't think I've ever met anybody that's gone back out that is thoroughly applying and implementing the principles and the steps. I just haven't. There's something missing.
Every once in a while, you'll hear somebody, and what'll happen is they'll have an operation, and it requires massive amounts of painkillers, and they can get caught up in that.
That makes
I've seen
sense.
That happen.
That makes sense.
You know, to good AAs.
Yeah.
But But for the most part, there's usually a weak link in the chain.
Yeah.
The weak link in the spiritual chain. So at once I think of my own doctor, William Duncan Silkworth, and how he ministered to me with the language of the heart during that last shattering years of my alcoholism. Love was his magic, and with it he accomplished this wonder. He conveyed to the foggy mind of the drunk that here was a human being who understood and who cared without limit. He was one who would gladly walk the extra mile with us, and if necessary, as it often was, even the last mile of all. At that time, he had already tried to help over 20,000 drunks, and he had failed with nearly all. Only here and there had this dismal experience of futility been brightened by a genuine recovery. People wondered how he could go on, how he could still believe in the possibility of help for chronic alcoholics. Yet he did believe, with a faith that never faltered. He kept saying, someday we'll find the answer. Now, Bill is kind of taking credit for being part of the answer. Now picture this, Monty. You're chief physician at a hospital specializing in drug and alcoholism treatment. And you're failing with just about everybody. And Bill Wilson shows up. He's got a case of religion, and he's putting some first century Christian principles into action. And he's trying to help other people by telling them that's what they should do. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, a whole bunch of hopeless alcoholics get sober and recover. And you know, this Dr. Silkworth, he encouraged all of this.
Yeah.
Because he had been with these alcoholics and he'd seen the tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. Yeah. Even if some wacky guy, you know, who's hanging out on the street corners, you know, preaching from soapboxes, even if that's the guy who seems to be getting something, you know, accomplished as far as recovery with these people, I'm in. Good for him.
Yeah.
And thank God that's the attitude he had. This whole thing could have blown up early on if he would have said, Bill, you're a crackpot, you know, stop sharing all these crackpot ideas, because that's something that could happen today. You know, that's happening today with people that specialize in the treatment of alcohol and drug addiction. They're saying the spiritual thing is nuts.
You
know what I mean?
Oh my God. So I know a guy who he's very well known within family therapy circles up here in the Pacific Northwest. And he was hired at a new medical facility. And in the paperwork, in the assessment paperwork that the clients fill out for drug and alcohol treatment, one of the questions is, do you have any religious beliefs that we need to be aware of so we can help you to grow in that aspect of your life? An unusual question for a secular program. So a person says, yeah. Lots of people say, yeah. And he's one of the guys that they turn this into, right? And so one of the clients asked him if he would pray for him. So he prayed for him. And then he got fired. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And it wasn't because of client's complaint. It was one staff member made a complaint, says, you can't do that because we're funded by the state. And so they fired him. And I'm like, why would you put a question like that in your intake paperwork if you weren't open to spiritual principles? I don't get it. But see, this is the world we live in today. You know, and it's interesting that here Dr. Silkworth sees the evidence, right? I mean, and it's proving itself out, and he can't deny it. And so he's going to back it. I wonder what it would be like today if this thing started today. I really do.
It couldn't start today.
It couldn't. Yeah,
you know, Monty, I believe something that's going to sound very negative and very dark, but I believe it's true. Whatever treatment or recovery processes can be reimbursed don't work. And the things that work, you can't find a way to get reimbursed for them.
That's right.
And if you look at this, Dr. Silkworth was running a hospital and it wasn't working. And Bill came in on his own dime, total volunteer, and what he did worked.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff is still true today. Now, I'm not saying there's not great things going on at some of these treatment centers that get, you know, private insurance and, sure, and Medicaid and all that. You know, there's real great life skill, you know, learning how to get along and conflict resolution, you know, yeah, trauma-informed recovery. There's all this great stuff. But if you're a real alcoholic, none of that's going to work.
That's right.
You know, if you're a real drug addict, none of that stuff's going to work. You're going to leave that place and you're going to feel good for a while and then you're going to relapse. And another thing that really gets me is, so you know, I'm part of, I'm part of the old NCADD. We've kind of changed our name now. Now, Monty, here's what we do. We manage a bunch of, welfare to work money. We're being given a grant by the state and it's eight figures of money every year. And what'll happen is if there's someone applying for who is on welfare who needs substance abuse, we have assessment people in all the counties and we send them to treatment and we pay for their treatment with this fund, this grant fund, and we manage the treatment. So we have people who are asking, you know, what are you doing? You know, yeah, they'll say, well, he's in stage two this week. And we'll go, well, that's fine. But that's not what we told you you needed to do with him. We don't care about your stage two. You know, here is our assessment. How are you addressing these things that we listed on the assessment? And every once in a while, someone will get thrown out for drinking. And we'll call them up and we'll say, we're aware that you discharged someone for drinking or drug use.
Discharge
them. Yes, that's true. And we go, why exactly did you do that? Well, because he used, okay. So let me get this straight. We're sending somebody to you for drug treatment or alcoholism treatment. We're paying you to do that treatment and they drink or they use drugs, which is certainly part of alcoholism or drug addiction, and you throw them out. How do you explain that? Because, you know, think if somebody goes in for cancer treatment and they're getting cancer treatment, and all of a sudden their cancer goes from stage two to stage four. Mm-hmm. Oh, you got to go, dude. Mm-hmm. You got to go. You're going to make our statistics look bad. No, that's not what happens. That's not what happens in any medical setting. Right.
Right. Right.
So why are you doing it to the alcoholic or the addict? The most normal thing in the world for an alcoholic or an addict to do is to drink or to use. We're sending them to you for treatment. It's your failure,
that's
not
right,
theirs.
Yep.
If they're drinking or using. Whatever you're doing, isn't working. So why don't you find something that works?
When I was working in that field, I'd see it all the time. Some poor guy, it's a non-smoking facility. Some guy would, 2 weeks in, picks up a cigarette butt and they kick him out for smoking. And my answer to that was he has untreated nicotine addiction. He's supposed to smoke.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Give me a break.
You know, it's just.
But you know what,
there's
Chris?
So much stigma. So much stigma.
You know what? What it comes down to is we still can't separate the medical from the moral. Right? We may spout all the time. We understand this is a medical condition. We understand it's a disease and an illness and everything else until you relapse. And now all of a sudden, you know, you're a spiritual failure. You know, you relapse because you're not serious. Now, I know, I don't believe that recovery is part that relapse is part of recovery until it happens, though, you know. And,
yeah,
and when it happens, it can be part of your recovery journey. So, we have a real hard time, just human beings in general, looking at this thing from a medical point of view. We preach it, but we have a hard time believing it.
So there's a great button that the NCADD would give out, right? And it's this. It says, it's not stigma, it's discrimination. Start calling it by the right name. you know what I mean? Start calling it by the right name.
Yeah.
So if I'm sending you, if I'm sending somebody to you for alcoholism treatment and the person is drinking, you're doing something wrong.
Amen.
You know, it's really easy to blame it on the person. He doesn't want it, or he's defiant, or, you know, he really didn't want help. Well, why did you take him and tell me that you could help him then?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, he had developed some ideas of his own about what ailed drunks. They had an obsession to drink, a veritable and destructive lunacy. Observing that their bodies could no longer tolerate alcohol, he spoke of this as an allergy. Their obsession made them drink, and their allergy was the guarantee that they would go mad or die if they kept it up. Here, in contemporary terms, was the age-old dilemma of the alcoholic. Total abstinence, he knew, was the only solution. But how to attain that? If only he could understand them more and identify them with them better, then his educational message could perhaps reach into those strange caverns of the mind where the blind compulsion to drink was entrenched. So that's what a lot of people think they need to do. They need to educate you.
Mm-hmm.
No. Listen, all the education is valuable. Just don't mistake it for something that's going to work. You know what I mean? Alcoholism.
So let me share this. I have a guy that I'm fond of who's in early recovery, and he came to me the other night and he goes, I'm so excited. I got my peer support specialist certificate and I got my board certified recovery mentor certificate. I'm so excited. But he doesn't go to meetings. He isn't working with anybody. I think he's been clean and sober all the time that it took him to get his certificate, right? And I'm like, I want to say, I was polite, but I want to say, so, but he's so entrenched in that, but he doesn't want to do the work that actually brings on a spiritual change in his life, you know. And I'm not sure why I went down that rabbit hole. But yeah, I don't know, brother. I'm... The recovery community can be very frustrating.
it can. Here's a phenomenon that happened. During the late 80s and into the early 90s, there was parity legislation with teeth.
Yeah.
So what would happen is if you raised your hand, every insurance company on the planet had to cover, you know, a 28-day stay at a rehab.
Yeah.
So what happened was a lot of people that went through rehab in the late 80s and early 90s, it was almost kind of a given that many of them would become alcohol counselors. It's just something that would happen because there were so many treatment centers out there.
Sure.
Now, I happen to know at least a half a dozen of these people. I've known them since then, right? Because I went to meetings with them back in the day. They haven't been to a meeting in decades.
Sure.
And they are counseling. They are counseling alcoholics. And it's a mess. Many of them have relapsed multiple times, holding on to their job counseling alcoholics, right?
Wow.
And not being a part of the recovery experience. Sometimes not even knowing that there really is a recovery experience because they never really went through the steps. They became alcohol counselors. So there's a million of those out there. And if you brought to their attention that there was a big gap in how they're approaching this whole employment and their own personal recovery, they would think you're crazy.
Yeah. 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 They do.
But you know, I can see it as plain as day. Put on that show Louder Milk. Okay. That's a beautiful example of a completely untreated alcoholic trying to treat other alcoholics. Have you seen that show on Netflix, Monty?
No. What's it called?
It's called Louder Milk, and it's oh really? My God. Right. Oh, you're going to hate it. The whole thing is about this guy who's an alcoholism counselor, drug counselor, and he's more dysfunctional than the people he's working with.
Oh, I got to watch it.
You got to watch it. It's hysterical. It's really funny. But it's one more thing that gives us a black eye. It's one more thing that shows group recovery settings being completely insane, which that's not necessarily how they are. You know what I mean?
So I remember what I was going to say about that. So I want to tell people, like my friend and people that do this stuff, they go to treatment and they get certified as this or that. Take everything you know, because my sponsor told me that, take everything you know and everything you think you know and put it in this box and give it to me and I'll let you have it back. But we're gonna go through this step process. You're going to have a spiritual experience and then a spiritual awakening. And then and only then we'll talk about giving it back to you. And when we do, if you have this experience, you will be able to apply and implement these wonderful tools that you received in treatment 100 times better than you will if you do it now. So why wouldn't you put pause on that and let's work on this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great way of looking at it. So the little doctor who loved drunks worked on, always in hope that the very next case might somehow reveal more of the answer. When I came to him, his more recent concepts and tactics had begun to produce slightly improved results. So he was encouraged, and he went after my situation with something of the enthusiasm and the hope of a young doctor in his first critical case. He told me what an infernal malady alcoholism is and why. He made no promises, and he did not try to conceal the poor recovery rate. For the first time, I saw and felt the full gravity of my problem. I learned also for the first time that I was a sick man emotionally and physically. As every AA today knows, this knowledge can be an enormous relief. I no longer needed to consider myself essentially a fool or a weakling or what I thought myself a scumbag.
Yeah.
This new insight plus the little doctor's account of a few of his good recoveries brought me a surge of hope. But above all, my confidence rested on the understanding, the interest, and the affection he so freely gave me. I was not alone anymore with my problem. He and I could work it through. Despite several discouraging slips, I truly believed this for quite a while, and so did he. But the hour finally arrived when he knew that I was not going to be one of the exceptions. He would have to begin to walk that last mile with my wife Lois and me. Characteristically, he found the courage gently but frankly to tell us the whole truth. Neither mine nor his nor any other resources he knew could stop my drinking. I would have to be locked up or suffer brain damage or death, perhaps within the year. And this guy was honest. I don't know that that's what you get today from people who fail their treatment process with you, you know, that they're going to be that honest. There's always something, you know, that they can offer you that'll work. It was a verdict I would not have accepted from any other person. He had spoken to me in the language of the heart. So I was able to receive the truth he offered me. But it was a terrible and hopeless truth. He spoke in the name of science, which I deeply respected, and by science I seemed condemned. Who else could have driven home this indispensable principle on which every recovery depends? I seriously doubt that any other man alive could have done it. Today, every AA member implants in his new prospect just what Dr. Silkworth so powerfully lodged in me. We know that the newcomer has to hit bottom. Otherwise, not much can happen. Because we are drunks who understand, we can use that nutcracker of the obsessive obsession plus the allergy as a tool of such power that it can shatter the newcomer's ego at depth. Only this can be, only thus can he be convinced that on his own, unaided resources, he has little or no chance. Monty, I told you this, I think last week. I do a talk at a treatment center every Wednesday, and every Wednesday I talk about the truth of step one. And I talk about it how important it is to have a true first step experience, understand the true nature of your first step experience. Because from that comes the motivation to do these unorthodox things that you don't think are going to work. You know, why are you going to do these things that aren't going to work? It's a waste of time, you know? So I was in precisely this state of inner collapse when in November of 1934, I was visited by Ebby. He was an old friend, an alcoholic, and my sponsor to be. Why was it that he could communicate with me in areas that not even Dr. Silkworth could touch? Well, first of all, I already knew that he himself was a hopeless case, just like me. Earlier that year, I had heard that he, too, was a candidate for the lockup. Yet here he was, sober and free. And his powers of communication now were such that he could convince me in minutes that he really felt he had been released from his drinking compulsion. He represented something very different from a mere jittery ride on the water wagon. And so he brought me a kind of communication and evidence that even Dr. Silkworth could not give. Here was one drunk talking to another. Here was hope indeed. I want to highlight that this sentence. He really felt he had been released. And Monty, that's how I describe my separation from alcohol today. That's the term that I use. Look at it like this. To get out of jail, you have to be released, right?
Yeah.
So yeah. I believe the same thing about alcoholic drinking. Mm-hmm. I believe I'm trapped and I need to be released. And God releases us. Wasn't that your experience?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I had every key under the sun to try to get me out of that cell. And you know what? Even in the face of God standing right there with his key, let me try one more, you know, and I just you come to a place where you're just like, okay. But the thing that's so like crazy about, and this is the insanity of alcoholism, well, not even just, I think it's the insanity of the human race, is we knowingly, knowing what the answer is, will try to do it our way anyway. Isn't that crazy? Until we're so beat up that we finally surrender. And that's what it takes. Do you think, let me ask you a question though. Because he talks about hitting bottom. Unless they hit bottom. Can we help raise people's bottoms?
Yes.
Amen. I agree with that too.
Yes. You don't have to lose everything and end up, you know, with pancreatic problems and liver problems. And,
yeah.
You know, you just don't need to go that far anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of accepting the truth of step one.
Yeah.
You know, step one was active in my life 15 years before I stopped drinking. And if there was someone who could have convinced me of it at that time, I might have 15 more years than I do now, you know, sober. So someone probably could have raised my bottom. It takes one drunk talking to another. It takes somebody who we're going to trust. We're going to have confidence in that they've been there and they know about what's going on with us.
Isn't it interesting that here is Ebby Thatcher, who at one time probably couldn't raise an inkling of credibility with anybody in his life, right? The person that he has credibility with is another drunk, you know? And so they had this relationship. And then he doesn't talk about it here so much, but he, unless we read on and he does, but Ebby's even been able to talk to him on spiritual matters that he's got a bad attitude towards, and he stomachs it. And he sits there and listens. Because as he says, you know, he can't argue with it. The evidence was sitting right across the table from him.
The lights were on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it says, Ebby told me his story, carefully detailing his drinking experiences of recent years. Thus, he drew me closer to him. I knew beyond doubt that he had lived in that strange and hopeless world where I still was. This fact established his identification with me. Mm. At length, our channel of communication was wide open, and I was ready for his message. And what was his message? All AAs know what it was. Honesty with oneself, leading to a fearless moral inventory of character defects, a revelation of those defects to another human being, the first humble and faltering steps away from isolation and guilt, willingness to face up to those we had harmed, making all possible restitution, a thorough house cleaning inside and out was indicated, and then we were ready to devote ourselves in service to others, using the understanding and language of the heart, and seeking no gain or reward. Then there was that vital attitude of dependence on God or a higher power. None of Ebby's ideas were really new. I'd heard them all before, but coming over his powerful transmission line, they were not at all what in other circumstances I would have regarded as a conventional cliches for good church behavior. They appeared to me as living truths which might liberate me as they had liberated him. He could reach me at depth. What a great way to put all this. But in one respect, I still backed away. I could not go for God because I could not believe there was any God. Ebby sold me his other ideas at once, but not this one. I could not share his faith as much as I had to admit it very evident result. That's very evident result. I had struck an impasse which thousands of incoming AAs have since collided. Mine was exactly the kind of deep-seated block we so often see today in new people who say they are atheistic or agnostic. Their will to disbelieve is so powerful that apparently they prefer a date with the undertaker to an open-minded and experiential quest for God. Happily for me, and for most of my kind who have since come along in AA, the constructive forces brought to bear in our fellowship have nearly always overcome this colossal obstinacy. Beaten into complete defeat by alcohol, confronted by the living proof of release, and surrounded by those who often speak to us from the heart, we have finally surrendered. And then, paradoxically, we have found ourselves in a new dimension, the new real world of spirit and of faith. Enough willingness, enough open-mindedness, and there it is. Wow, what a powerful paragraph.
You know, I think I don't know, maybe I'll talk to God about this when I see him when I move on, but I'll bet you this was so important in God's choosing Bill that Bill was somebody who had a problem with God. I think that was important. And I mean, it's easy to pick somebody that agrees with you to go camping with you, right? But you got to take somebody who doesn't like you, or doesn't even believe in you, and you change their mind. They become advocates for your cause like no one else, and I think that's why he chose Bill.
Yeah, you know, if Pope McGillicuddy would have come up with this whole program, right?
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have gone for it.
Right.
You know? But Bill, I can relate to Bill.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. When my own time for open-mindedness and surrender finally came, that new world of spirit burst upon me in a flash of overwhelming conviction and power. As a result, freedom from obsession, faith in God, and a consciousness of his presence have remained with me ever since, regardless of subsequent ups and downs. The gift of faith instantaneously became built into me. My pride had paid a very high price. In despair, I had cried out, "Now I am willing to do anything. If there is a God, will he show himself?" And he did. This was my first conscious contact, my first awakening. I asked from the heart, and I received. With this illumination came the vision of a possible chain reaction, one alcoholic working with the next. I was convinced that I could give to fellow sufferers that which Ebby had given to me. And for months afterward, I tried to carry the message, but nobody sobered up. A wonderful lesson came out of the experience. I was painfully learning how not to communicate. No matter how truthful the words of my message, there could be no deep communication if what I said and did was colored by pride, arrogance, intolerance, resentments, impudence, or desire for personal acclaim, even though I was largely unconscious of these attitudes. Without realizing it, I had fallen pretty heavily into these errors. My spiritual experience had been so sudden, brilliant, and powerful that I had begun to be sure I was destined to fix just about all the drunks in the world. Here was pride. I kept harping on my mystical awakening, and the customers were uniformly repelled. Here was impudence. I began to insist that every drunk should have a bright light uplift, just about like mine. I ignored the fact that God comes to man in many ways. I had begun, in effect, to say to my clients, you must be as I am. Believe as I believe, do as I do. Here was the sort of unconscious arrogance that no drunk can stand. I loudly began to point out the sins of my prospects, mostly, of course, the sins I supposed I didn't have, and the prospects got sore, and so did I. When they got drunk, I got mad, and here was hurt pride again.
Yeah.
You know, I think everybody goes through an evangelical period,
I
right,
think you're
Monty?
Right.
I mean, you've missed something if you didn't bang the book for a while, right?
I tried to convert a small meeting up in Sweet Home, Oregon, and get them to follow those traditions and get on. I mean, if you'd only do things right, then this meeting would grow. But yeah. The meeting isn't even there anymore, let alone growing or anything. But you know what? I got a buddy who says, you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous has been doing just fine without me for a long time.
And we needed AA more than AA needs us, that's
right,
for sure.
Right, right. All right. Okay, are we going to stop at this point?
Yes. Yes, okay. We are. That's halfway through this.
All righty. I'll mark that off there. Well, good stuff. I hear in the last couple of paragraphs, I hear his writings coming through loud and clear. Basically, just because you get sober, don't be going trying to convert everybody. They're probably not going to receive it. And slow down and touching on humility based on his own experience and his own ego. That's why I love this guy. He's transparent. He
learned how to go from you need to do this to this is what I did.
Yeah.
That was his transformation.
So a short story as we close out. I remember years ago when I was attending Bible college for the purpose of converting others. That's why I went. And also because I thought I would convince my parents that I wasn't going to drink anymore. and that didn't turn out well. But I went there, and one of the first things that they wanted us to do as new students is they gave us these little four spiritual law pamphlets, and they wanted us to go out to San Jose State University and talk to people about Jesus, right? And so I was like, oh, yeah, I'm all gung-ho and everything. And I was watching other people do it, and Chris, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't. I didn't know if it was fear. I didn't know what it was, but I couldn't do it. And we tried a couple of times, and I was just, I ended up sitting in my car, and I was talking to one of my Bible college professors about this dilemma, and this is what he told me. He says, well, it's interesting they had you do that. He says, I kind of take it from a different point of view. I think we ought to do what the apostles did. Just tell people what God did for you. You don't have to tell people what they need to do. Just tell them what God did for you. And then people will listen. And that's exactly what happened. When I started doing that, and then God would bring people into my life that would ask me. I didn't even have to make an approach. What do you got? Why are you so happy in the midst of, you got two flat tires and you're not angry and blah, blah, then you have an opportunity to share what God's done for you. You don't have to go out and try to convert anybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I get it. All right, my friend. Well, thank you everybody for tuning in and listening. Remember, you can download all of these, 66 of them right now. There'll be many more before we're done. So listen to the very end of this little thing here that as we close out to find out how to do that. Chris, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure.
Yes, and you have a good trip and enjoy the barbecue, man. And we'll talk to you when you get back. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
All right, my friends, until our next broadcast, this is the Monty Man along with Chris S. And we are wishing God's perfect serenity for you. For more recovery workshops with Chris S. and the Monty Man, visit our website at take12radio.com and click on the Recovery Workshops banner.
This has been a broadcast of Take 12 Recovery Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting.
This has been a Chicken and a Pig production.
Kitty, 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 kitty. Meow, meow, meow.
Woof, woof.